There's a trite piece of advice that every man has heard 1,000 times and is bored of hearing. Choose a woman for her character, not her beauty. This old bromide applies, of course, generally to everyone in choosing a romantic partner, but men in particular ignore it. And we won't repeat that advice here. I contend that the savvy seducer can get both virtue and beauty in one package. And that's what I did. And I wrote a 500-page book about how to make that magic happen. How to seduce the enduring affections, passion, and commitment of a virtuous woman. A philosophy that resulted in a happy 7-year marriage and a beautiful baby that she is lovingly taking care of in the other room as I'm recording this. Recently, I finished a book that makes an almost comically perfect companion to mine, Venus Flytrap, the memoir of a man who seduced the enduring affections of a succubus from the 9th circle of hell. I'm speaking metaphorically, just barely. Venus Flytrap is a rather spicy memoir detailing the author's turbulent and deeply self-destructive relationship with a former model who appears hell-bent on infusing chaos into the lives of anyone near her vicinity. It's a story of attraction to anarchy, of confusing intensity with intimacy, and of repeatedly mistaking volatility for progress. What makes the book interesting and why I'd recommend it as a useful companion to my own work is its honesty. The author doesn't merely document her instability, he documents his own failures, the boundaries he didn't enforce, the red flags he sped right past in a not-so-metaphorical Rolls Royce, the bad game that lost him frame control over the relationship, the mindset errors that earned him exactly the force of chaos that he invited into his life, bed, and beautiful home. Today, I'm joined by Stephen Paul Edwards, who has a PhD in spiritual counseling and over 20 years working alongside leaders like Anthony Robbins, Robert Kiyosaki, Dean Graziosi. Stephen brings an experiential lens to personal growth, along with some good storytelling, I hope, in this podcast. And he's the author of Venus Flytrap. I'm Jonathan Rosent. Stephen, welcome to Limitless.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. That was quite an introduction. Very nice to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
First question. In the media, we often see something very odd. Prominent elite men who appear to have low standards with the women they choose as wives or partners. I'm talking about the top 1% of the top 1% of men. I'm thinking billionaires like Jeff Bezos or Prince Harry, who chose to marry somewhat beautiful yet middle-aged women with a lot of baggage and history, or Emmanuel Macron of France with a wife 25 years his senior. Donald and Melania Trump are probably the most conspicuous exception to this. You would think these kinds of men could get more of the ideal, more of a clean slate woman in her 20s. You'd think they would hire elite dating coaches or matchmakers to filter out women who were anything less than the evolutionary ideal or had a bunch of sordid history. You would think they would choose women a little more like Elon Musk or Leonardo DiCaprio do. Yet, we see this repeatedly. So, Stephen, what do you surmise on this? Why do elite men sometimes have low standards?
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that presupposition. So let me tell you why. If you look at marriage as a whole, it doesn't matter whether you're wealthy, one of the 1% elite, or someone coming from more impoverished circumstances. Marriage is not easy, and in most cases, it doesn't work. And we're all looking for different things, right? So you're talking about, you know, finding someone that has more virtue. Many men don't want a virtuous woman. They want a woman who's had experience, lived a life. Now, it doesn't mean they can't make a mistake, right? But, you know, how many marriages, Jonathan, are what we would call successful? And what does successful look like? You know, if I, you know, someone says to you, I want to be successful, well, you're going to say, well, define that. What does that mean? Because what success means to you doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to me. And not only do marriages not work and end in divorce, but there's a lot of marriages that are not working, but people stay together. There are a lot of marriages that one person thinks is going really well, but the other person is very unhappy, but never says anything about it, right? So it's not easy to find a relationship. It's not easy to find a partner. And until you spend some time with someone, you don't really know. So some people say, well, I'm not going to live with someone until I'm married. Okay. But then you've got to realize that if you do that, when you do live with them, you're going to find a lot of things that you didn't know. So everything has an advantage and a disadvantage to it, right? But I think we're all different people, and none of us are raised. I would say none of us, the vast majority of people are not raised with anyone really teaching them or necessarily being a good role model of what a healthy relationship is like. It's not part of our educational curriculum. And most people find themselves having to find that out through, you know, trial and error, right? And that's not easy because, you know, getting into a marriage is easy. Getting out is not necessarily that easy. But we also live in a society today, Jonathan, where you look back 20 years ago, or maybe longer, people only had a small pool of people to choose from. You lived in a town, and whatever women were there, whatever men were there, you had to choose from that pool. Not anymore. You've got people from all over the world to choose from. So the more choices creates more instability. You wanted to say something.
Yeah, I have an interesting little anecdote for what you're alluding to, the geographic regulation of the sexual marketplace. And if you want to see a stark example of this, people can go and look up old photos of World War I soldiers with their wives. And some of these World War I soldiers are like guys that look like kind of like chumps. And they're with like rather attractive women, all of them. And so like what that is geographic regulation of sexual marketplace, that there's a little town in England and there's a very set amount of maidens and bachelors there. And so, but yeah, that world is very, very gone. Please continue.
Yeah, you're right. And men and women are attracted to different things, right? So men, as you pointed out, tend to be attracted more to the physical beauty of a woman. And a woman tends to be attracted more to the confidence and financial security that a man can offer. Not always, but that is making a generality there, right? So often women are very insecure about their looks and their beauty. They're afraid of losing it. And men are very often very insecure about their financial stability and their ability to take care of a woman and keep her interested in him without her going to be with somebody else who's richer than him, right? So these are issues that we deal with as society. And many people, again, I'm just generalizing here. I know everybody's different, but many people will see, you know, what we call it, gold diggers. Women will go after the men that have got the most money, can give them the most security. And men will go after the most beautiful women. But as you've already also said, that doesn't mean they're going to make a happy relationship. They don't know anything about each other's character, right? And whether that character is in alignment with theirs or what they're looking for, right? And so one of the other things that you talked about is, you know, I've had all these years of studying personal and spiritual development. And you mentioned that I had a relationship with Tomas. Well, I was making conscious decisions throughout that. It's not really talked about in the book much, but it is a little bit, you know, I would say, because as you know, I talk to the reader, right? And we have a conversation with the reader and I say, so you probably think I'm crazy for going back, right? For going out with her. But you got to realize something. If I didn't, you wouldn't be enjoying this book right now, would you? You would be enjoying this story, right? But I was enjoying the actual story as well, because as much craziness as there was in this whole thing, and you're right, it was really, really crazy. I mean, stuff that was going on was way over the top. But at the same time, it was way over top in the other way. The times that we had, the exciting travel, the amazing sexual relationship we had, the days spent together in our cocoon at the mansion, in the sex room, sitting by the pool, playing backgammon, it was a fantasy. And we lived a fantasy life much of the time when we weren't getting arrested or doing things that caused havoc, right? So I, and as it mentions in the book, right, I was diagnosed as a manic depressive when I was about 16. And I had a bout of mania that meant I was admitted to a mental institution, right? And I had electric shock treatment and had all those things, which ended up being not only traumatic at the time, the whole thing, but also affecting my life for the rest of my life, right? So throughout most of my life, I had depression, right? I suffered from depression. But my life has been very high and very low, right? I've made and lost millions of dollars. I've had everything you could ever want, and I've lost everything, right? So that's my life. And so I attracted Tomas into my life because she's the same way. So we were mirrors of each other. And we were also master teachers for each other. I know you know what that means, right? So as a spirit, we have all kinds of teachers that come into life. We also have master teachers. And she was a master teacher for me. So as much madness and mayhem as there was a tremendous amount of healing that came at this for me. Because it made me or pushed me into facing my own demons, Jonathan. You know, we all have light. We all have darkness, as you know, right? We all have a light side and a dark side to our nature. And it pushed me or forced me to look at my dark side that I really didn't necessarily know I had, that I was pushing down, and it was causing me to be in a prison because I was always subconsciously concerned if people found out about my dark side and either didn't love me anymore or, you know, didn't want to be my friend anymore or whatever. So by doing this and then putting it into a book, as you said, I reveal it all. I don't hold anything back, right? I tell everybody about my air wart, right? But it gave me a freedom I would never otherwise had, Jonathan, you know? And she brought that into my life. So yeah, it was crazy. Yes, there were downsides. A lot of people would call it a toxic relationship, but it was what I needed. And one of the things that I realized about this, and I know you can relate to this, very often from the goodness of our heart, we want to help people, right? We want to, you know, we can see a situation. We can see the train coming down the tracks and we're trying to get someone out of the way of the train, right? And they can't see it. And they say, no, I'm happy on the tracks. And you're like, no, listen, the train is coming. It's going to kill you, right? Whatever it is. But sometimes there's nothing wrong with saying that, but sometimes you have to let it go and realize, yeah, well, I guess they need the train to hit them, right? And from that experience, that's a little bit of an exaggerated situation. But by going through this experience, it's going to give them the lessons, the understanding that they need. And so people were telling me, you know, you got to get out of this. People used to say to me, listen, you shouldn't even be in the same state as her, let alone the same room. But I would then make a conscious decision. I would say, well, yeah, it's crazy. I'm crazy too. And I'm attracted to that character. She was everything I wanted. She was wild. She was sexual. She was funny. She was incredibly intelligent, right? So usually there is an advantage and a disadvantage to everything, right? So yeah, the disadvantage was the chaos, the interactions or troubles we got into, but the upsides were even bigger for me. And so I was prepared to put up with that for a certain amount of time. Now, you've read book one. Well, in book two and book three, you discover why all this is happening, right, for her, and what the actual end solution was to the issue. And it wasn't what most people will think, that I grew tired of her or that I didn't want to do this anymore. That wasn't the reason. It was much deeper and much more tragic than that.
Master teacher, that's a phrase that I actually haven't heard before. I'm gathering the concept is that the universe brings other people into our lives at crucial times so that we can learn the lessons that we are meant to learn in this life.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's a concept I'm actually not familiar with in my spirit. I haven't studied spiritual stuff that much. I mean, I've read most of the Bible and some other spiritual things, but I guess I haven't gone as deep down that rabbit hole as you. But you do have a PhD in spiritual healing, so you should be teaching me a thing or two in that department.
Well, here's the thing as well, right? So you just talked about two very different things. The Bible is not spiritual. The Bible is religious, right? Spirituality is very different than religion, all right? A succinct way I heard someone define the difference, which is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, that religion is something people study because they don't want to go to hell. Spirituality is for people who have already been to hell, right? So you kind of have the breakthrough. Spirituality is very different than religion, right? It's not dogmatic. It's very open to almost everything. And spirituality is not about worshiping a God, right? That in spirituality, everything is God. There is nothing that isn't God, right? So they have, everything is sacred. If you think about it, if God created the earth and everything in it, then everything in the earth and that's in it is God, because it had to come from a source, and that source is the creator, right? Now, you can give it a name, but it's not a person. There's no God up in the sky looking down on earth and people and making decisions. What we tend to do as human beings is we tend to personify things. But actually, the story of the Bible is written in the stars, and that's how people worshiped in the before anybody started writing things, they saw the story, 12 disciples, the 12 astrological signs, and on it goes, right? On it goes. All of those things are in the stars and in nature. And we are a part of nature. There's no separation. We have the illusion of separation because you're there, I'm here. But there is no separation because between us both right now, there are molecules. We can't see them necessarily, but if you move your hand in front of your face, you can feel them, right? Which is why sometimes you can be thinking about someone that's close to you, emotionally close to you, but they're on the other side of the world. You'll be thinking about them and the phone will ring, right? Because they felt that energy. Oh, let me call Jonathan. I need to talk to him, right? So, and I think as human beings going through conscious evolution, we're beginning to understand that. So anyway, the bottom line is I drew Tamaz into my life. There's no blame there. I'm actually very grateful that I did. I'm grateful to her. I loved her then and I love her now. We're not in each other's lives because it no longer makes sense for us to be in each other's lives, right? But so I don't think of it as a mistake. I think of it as an amazing growth period in my life for which I'm very grateful for.
people might be curious. I did, Tomas. People will not find her by Google image searching Tomas model. Sorry, you won't find her that way. However, as a journalist, loosely speaking, I did a little bit of cyber sleuthing because some of the parts of the book struck me as like a bit fantastic. And so I did a little bit of cyber sleuthing to validate the wealth that you talked about. And I did find your name on the Sarasota house. So yeah, I tried to confirm a little bit of the parts of the story that made me say, really? Is he making things up here? But switching gears, let's get a little bit more.
Yep. Let me just say one thing. Her name is not Tomas. I changed her name for the book.
Good thinking. Hopefully she appreciates that.
Well, we'll find out. Because funnily enough, we haven't been in touch since we broke up.
Good.
But she does know that I've written this book because she posted something on my social media that she knows. But this is the first time in probably 8 years that we've connected.
Okay. So let's get a little bit more tactical and practical in the seduction department. And in the book, you are like very, you take a whole lot of responsibility for this whole disaster. And
it wasn't a disaster. What are you talking about? This whole episode, right? This whole story. Yes. Yeah. I take full responsibility, Jonathan. I created it all, right? As we do, right? We create everything ourselves, right? But anyway, go ahead. It just made me laugh.
Sure. I think your main sin here is having low standards. And low standards as far as boundary enforcement and as far as not walking away from this when your best friend told you should have. Okay, here is the point go ahead.
So I think there's a little bit of judgment on your side.
Yes.
First of all, okay, well, that's okay. We can talk about it. So first of all, what does sin mean?
To you. Using that just in a very general,
Okay. But, sin actually in its original form just simply means separation. So to commit a sin means that you have or you do believe that we're separate, that you could do something to me or I could do something to you, right? So when you say low standards, I mean, she's an international supermodel. She's an equestrian horse rider. She's extremely intelligent. She's the daughter of a billionaire. So I don't know that you would consider that to be low standards. Most people would say that. Most guys would say that's pretty high standards. And then setting boundaries. You do need to set boundaries in life. And there were some boundaries, but probably not enough, right? However, just about everybody around you is probably going to break your boundaries at some point. And then you've got to make a decision. Is that boundary so important to me that I don't want to have that person around? I don't want to date that person. Don't want to be that person. And so none of the boundaries that she broke were that important to me that I would say I'd rather not have her in my life than have her in my life. So it wasn't like I wasn't aware of it. As you read in the book, I'm perfectly aware what's going on, right? And what she's doing and how she lies and manipulates and did all those things. But on the other side, the upside was greater than those downsides for me at that time. So I have very high standards, you know, which is why I've been so successful in some of the things that I do. In that relationship, I don't know that I lowered my standards. You could argue that point. But I didn't keep boundaries in place that I would keep with most people, right? I did let her do things and get away with things. that I'd never done with any woman in my life before, but I'd never been in love with a woman like I was in love with her before either. So there was that dichotomy. I just wanted to make that point.
Okay. Counter argument from your book. To quote, "I'll reduce the amount I drink," she offered, her voice firm but distant. The oracle turned back to me, coming in for the final close. "Stephen, is that acceptable to you to get things moving along? In other words, take what you can get here. This is a stepping stone." "Yes," I said. And that this passage illustrates so well the failure of compromise. I am not a big fan of compromise, particularly early in relationships. As a man, early in a relationship, you do not want to be doing compromise. And in fact, I have another quote from your book that makes this point even better than me. "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man." And particularly in the beginning of the relationship, when you buy yourself tranquility and happiness by establishing frame control early in the relationship. And when you compromise early in the relationship, then you get chaos, which your book is so beautifully illustrates. Now, am I saying never compromise? No. I compromise with my wife on things from time to time. However, what works a lot better than compromise is negotiation. And actually, the way that my wife and I have resolved several conflicts, and people are going to think this is maybe a little crazy, we've resolved several long-running conflicts by negotiating addendum agreements to our marriage. We wrote down contracts enumerating responsibilities, expectations, and then we signed these contracts, and then we stick with them. And that's worked in my marriage. And I've also done that with a couple other relationships, even with a family member, where there was kind of some on-again, off-again estrangement with family members due to some patterns that we were in. And we negotiated addendum agreements, and then we signed them and kept to them. Here's kind of a tactical takeaway, and then Stephen is gonna jump in, possibly disagreeing. We'll see. Here's the tactical takeaway for guys here, particularly for single guys, is I contend that a combination boundaries, a bit of being unreasonable, a bit of being very firm, and a combination of good game. These three things together in the beginning of the relationship are something that can tame a woman a little bit. The right kind of woman, they can bring her into the right kind of alignment if they are done early in the relationship. And because with it's important. I recommend very strongly to guys, like especially if they get out of a divorce, along with whatever personal development stuff that they do, go and study game, go and study the art of seduction some, so that when you get into that first relationship, however long that interim is, that you are properly seducing that woman. And that is something that just buys a lot of long-term tranquility. Go ahead, Stephen.
Okay, well, there's a lot of presuppositions in there, Jonathan. So We're all different. So for example, you're very analytical. You're very mind-driven. Nothing wrong with that, right? I'm more emotionally driven, right? So for me, having contracts in a relationship, which it just wouldn't work, right? And I would feel like I was trying to mold someone into what I wanted them to be instead of allowing them to be who they are and deciding if that person who they are, the truth of them, is someone I want to be with. So to me, what came to my mind is, you know, the right kind of woman. There's no such thing, right? But the right kind of relationship. It's like saying, you want to be successful. Well, what does that mean? You know? So I don't know that there's a right or wrong kind of relationship. There's just relationships. And then you've got to decide if that's something you want to be in or not. The minute we try and control something outside of ourselves, we're going to have problems. We're never going to be happy. Because truthfully, we really can't control. The only thing we can really control is ourselves, right? So to me, what came to my mind is, well, the way you're seeing this, that a woman has got to be a certain way, the way you want it to be, you got to write contracts. It was kind of like training a dog, right? To me, it's just what came to my mind. Now, seduction is a different thing, right? So women can be seduced, but they're not all seduced the same way. Now, there are generalities. There are certain things that tendencies for men and women, I would definitely agree with that. But women like to be seduced in different ways. Some women like men that are very, you know, today there's a lot more of a spectrum of sexuality than was noticed in the past, right? It's much easier, you know, since the pill being introduced in the 1960s and we started that sexual revolution, people see sex very differently. You know, there were consequences to having sex with a lot of men back then, right? Both socially and also health and also in terms of becoming pregnant, which is a big issue, right? So since the sexual revolution, I think that all of that structure that was a big part of our society has fallen away and it's been confusing. It's confused a lot of people about what it means. You know, you hear women say today, oh, I don't need a man, which to me is absolutely ridiculous, right? Well, why was man created? Okay, I'll let you go with that, right? I know I got off on a little pitch there. Go ahead.
You said women say, I don't need a man. My wife started writing a book that was going to be entitled, I Don't Need a Man and Other Myths Robbing You of True Love. She started writing a book by that very title. But life got, she hasn't finished the book yet. But actually, she published a chapter of the book, which I will link to in the show notes for this episode. But I had to, you've got someone here that agrees with that sentiment. So please continue.
Yeah, you know, and so making that, saying that is, these are the reasons that our social structure, that one and others, are causing our social structure to fall apart. And yes, there was a long period of time the women were considered second-class citizens, right? That it was the man that told the woman what to do, the woman had to obey the man, etc. And my feeling, now we kind of got off on a tangent here, I don't know how we got this way, but I feel the pendulum has swung too far the other way. That, not again, I'm generalizing here, right? But it is a strong generality that women now treat men with disrespect and they treat them badly. And if you were to say the same thing to a woman that women say to men, there would be complete uproar. You know, that men would be vilified, right? So we've kind of like got to bring the pendulum a little bit back to the center, because men are getting to the point where they don't want to be with a woman, right? Or they don't want to be with a woman from this society because of the way they're treated. And a lot of men are going abroad, right? You know that, right? A lot of men are going to other countries where women are more appreciative of the men. And so again, that's another thing that's causing, you talk about chaos and mayhem in our society, right? Because of this, some people call it the sexual revolution, that everything is changing about how men see women and how women see men, which is, at this point, in the journey, it's a little destructive. And men are feeling very alone, very outcast by society, which is why it's very important the work that you're doing is giving men a sense of community that they can come to and talk about things that they might find difficult in other arenas.
And moving abroad to find love, to find what I desired, that's what I did. And I regard it as the best decision of my life. And in my book, Don't Stick Your Dick in a Blender, How to Meet a Nice Girl Instead from a Tantric Husband with a Better Sex Life Than You, in this book, I list, I think it's 39 different countries that have a beautiful women plus somewhat traditional culture.
Yes, yes.
So, okay, switching gears, Venus Flytrap, your book, it's a great title. And I wanted to explain, or you go ahead and explain the title, please.
Sure. Well, we met online, which is never usually a good idea. But anyway, we met online and we were going backwards and forwards. I was trying to get a date with her, got her to say she'll have coffee one day, and the next day she canceled. Nightmare. So we finally tied her down to go for dinner. And I was trying to make sure that we tied this down, right? Not realizing at the time she liked to be tied down. But anyway, so I wanted to do something that was going to secure the date, right? So I texted her, we're going to have this date. It's going to be amazing, which it was. And, what's your favorite flower? So she texted back, bird of paradise. So you can tell from the writing the book, I'm a bit of a jokester, right? I joke around all the time, right? So I said, mine too. And then I said, but it's a bit expensive though. What's your second favorite? And she texted back instantly, Venus Flytrap. So she named the book. She was the Venus Flytrap and I was the fly. And that metaphor was a perfect metaphor for the book, because she was trying to devour me, take me for everything initially, right? Because as it explains in the book, she was put into a mental institution when she was 16 by her father. And so obviously she was angry at him for that. She couldn't get out. And so she thought she hated her father, but she didn't really. She just wanted him to love her the way she wanted to be loved. But anyway, so then she's this beautiful young girl who is having men around her like flies all the time. And with this belief, and I know you talk about beliefs, right, that drive our behavior, that drive our lives, her belief was, well, if my father doesn't love me, then who is ever going to love me? So she believed she was unlovable and that men only wanted to be around her for sex. And so she decided to make her life purpose destroying wealthy men. So she would lure them in to the fly trap with her nectar, with her beauty, and then destroy them and take them for everything. And she'd done it numerous times, which I think I mentioned in the book. And she was about to do that to me, and she almost did. But I was the fly, and I got away, and I kept getting away until in the end, she said to herself, well, maybe he does care about me. Maybe I am lovable. Maybe he does love me because he's not going away. Most men by now would be gone. And I'd never see him again. So here we were in this dichotomy. So the next thing, then she decided she wanted to marry me. And I also knew that her attraction to me was the game. Playing the game. Just like backgammon. Backgammon was throughout our entire relationship. So we played backgammon because we were both very competitive and she always wanted to win. Well, our relationship was the same. It was a reflection of the game, right? You talk about game, right? So our relationship was a game, and I knew if I ever did marry her, the game would be over.
Yeah, you made the right decision not to make her Mrs. Edwards. And okay, in the book, you write, Venus Flytrap, the predator had just named herself. People always tell you who they are when you first meet them. We just don't listen. And yeah, that's a Good point. A lot of times early on in relationship, there's a statement or there's some obvious behavior that we speed right past in the metaphorical or not so metaphorical Rolls Royce. And I can draw a comparison to my wife here. There was a thing she told me really early on in our relationship that really stuck with me. And it ended up being, kind of one of those self-fulfilling prophecy things. Mm-hmm. We had taken our first romantic getaway to the resplendent Black Sea coast. And we checked into our Airbnb. And after the long travel, I was really ready to get out and go get some of the succulent seafood there on offer in this resort town. But as we're walking out of the hotel, she stops to smoke a cigarette because she's European. And at the time, she smoked cigarettes. And so she's standing there smoking a cigarette. And I say, "Babe, let's go to the restaurant already. You can walk and smoke." And she responds to me in her alluring Eastern European accent, "Only hookers walk and smoke."
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. So that's how it is in that her society. Yeah, right.
And it rings. It was one of those things where it just struck me with the brilliant novelty and beauty that was surrounding me at that moment. It's a statement of a dignity, sure identity, and a statement that clearly she holds her ground on at least some things. And actually she quit smoking cigarettes for me. I think it was several weeks later, I sat down and had a conversation with her, a very diplomatic kind of conversation, but where I set pretty firm boundary that I couldn't see myself in a relationship with a smoker. And then I told her, "Hey, I'm going to give you the biohacks that are going to make it easier for you to quit smoking." And so she quit and stayed. But yeah, that was one of those things that popped out at me early in the relationship that turned out to be a good character sign.
So with Tomas, when I realized the first date we went on, so she said, "I got to go outside and get a cigarette," right? My heart dropped. I'm like, "You got to be kidding me." But she wasn't. And I did try to get her to stop smoking, but she just wanted it. You know, here was the thing with Tomas. Because of this mental illness that she had, which we won't get into right now, we're going to get into in the second book, she couldn't handle reality. So her need to escape reality was so intense. She did drugs. She had alcohol, sex, smoking. To take those away from her, and this sounds a little strange, but I can assure you it's true, she would rather die then you take those from her, because they were her only way, in her mind, to cope. And, you know, you read the funny story about us going for a therapy session and how it worked out. She would never have gone to therapy on any ongoing basis because of her being locked up in an asylum when she was young. And she would always be afraid that if the therapist decided she needed to get Baker acted or whatever, she'd end up back in the asylum. So she was never, ever going to do any kind of therapy or residential addiction programs. Her father had put her in, as it's mentioned in the book, her father had tried to put her in rehab many times, and she just used to walk out, right? She would just leave. So that was just not on the agenda. So earlier you were talking about lowering your standards, right? So I didn't drink. It's not that I'd never drunk or ever had a drink, but when I met to Mars, I wasn't drinking, and I hadn't drunk in a long time. So she drank. So I did join her in that, right? So you could say, well, you did lower your standards there because you were drinking before, and then you actually went into her world rather than got her into your world. And that's true. That is true. But I made that decision consciously. And it wasn't like I hadn't enjoyed alcohol before. And I didn't like drink all the time. It would just be occasionally if we went out. But still, that is a point of, you could, I call it compromise. You could call it lowering your standards. So I believe if you go into relationship and demand that people have do things your way to begin with, I think that can be difficult for most people here in the United States. In Europe, a lot easier to do that with women in Europe because they're used to very strong, dominating men. So again, it goes back to a little bit of culture. And that's another reason why men like yourself look for the right kind of woman for them in countries where they are more traditional. Nothing wrong with that, right?
Switching gears, I wanted to talk some about toxic relationships. And this is something I don't know that much about because I always got right out of any relationship that was edging towards toxicity. My most toxic relationship was probably with a business partner. And after not long, I just sat down with him one night and I had a document. I like documents. I had a document printed up that just said, here's a document. I'm giving the company over to you. And we signed it. And that was the end of that. And then I have a funnier story about getting out of what could have been a toxic relationship. I guess I don't really know. In Colombia, I was seeing Andrea. And one night, we had gone out to a disco, and she got me somewhat inebriated. And then she draws close in between the vertical lap dances to the reggaeton music. She draws close to me and she says, Jonathan, I'd really love it if you could buy me a DVD player. And I said, a DVD player? She said, yeah, like a DVD player so that I can play movies for my son. And I immediately knew that was the moment that I had to say, or I knew I had to say no to that, but I had the sense to not get in an argument over a DVD player in a disco at 2 a.m. So I just kind of nodded and then said, bailamos. But then I knew what was coming after that. I knew that after the DVD player, she would ask me to pay her rent, child support things I'm sure I would have gotten roped into. So the next day, I texted her. I didn't bring up the DVD player, but I told her I didn't want to see her anymore because she had tempted me with cigarettes. She knew that I used to smoke cigarettes and then I quit and she would tempt me with cigarettes when we were out partying. And so I told her that I was breaking up with her over her tempting me with cigarettes. And so wish Andrea the best. But I've got some questions for you because you know more about toxic relationship. I'm curious if your level of success actually made you more vulnerable. When you had the mansion, the Rolls, the Bentley, did you start to feel like you could fix or conquer a partner like Thomas because you had conquered the business world?
Well, that's a good question. Did I feel like I could conquer Thomas because I'd conquered the business world?
You conquered her sexually, of course, but in other ways.
I don't know. I think she was probably more the leader in that than I was. But anyway, she was a challenge to me. And here's the thing, just like you, I'd had many occasions when I knew or realized that a woman was looking for money or what she could get, and I would end that immediately. I would never do that, right? She didn't want or need me for money. Her father's a billionaire, right? At any time, she could reconcile with her father and have all the money she wanted in the world. So it never was about that. It was, but having said that, I think where my train of thought was going with that now. There were things that I didn't like her smoking, like her drinking too much, right? I didn't like that, although there was an upside to both those things as well. But again, you talk about compromise. I was prepared to put up with her smoking because she didn't smoke all the time, but she smoked. She did smoke. And I was prepared to put up with the drinking because I would partake sometimes. So it would have been hippie. Eventually, I just realized, look, she's not going to stop. I got to make a decision. Is that a big enough issue for me to not want to be with her or not be with her, as opposed to all the extraordinary things that I get to enjoy with her? And I kept coming to the conclusion, I'd rather be with her. My life would be boring without her. I love excitement. I'm an adrenaline junkie, right? You know, we never did like a values or a rules, a comparison. Seems like you did that. And there's nothing wrong with that. That does usually mean if your values are aligned and you understand each other's rules, you're going to have a happier relationship. I was more interested in having a woman that would excite me. I like crazy, right? Almost all the women I've been a little crazy. And I like that. So neither one is right or wrong. It's what is right for you, right? What suits you best? Are you, you know, for you, those would have potentially been compromises that you wouldn't be prepared to make. Fine. So you found a woman who fits in with all your values and your rules and is happy to do them. That's great. It's just different strokes for different folks, right? So now I haven't dated in a long time, probably over 3 years. I've never found anybody that's made me want to be with them. Now, a couple of clarifications. I wouldn't want to go through what I went through in that memoir again, right? That's just not where I'm at in my life. You know, what do they say? You never step into the same river twice, right? So we're now both of us very completely different people than we were then. Just like there are things that you probably did when you were a teenager that you might not have interest in anymore. Nothing wrong with that. You've just matured or grown in a different direction. And so have we. But at the time, she was everything I wanted. There's definitely some issues that I would prefer she didn't have. But overall, I took those into account and said, I want to stay until I didn't anymore. And that's in the next book.
Reading the book, it seemed to me that this was a case of lack of abundance mindset, which is understandable as you were coming out of a divorce. This was a rebound relationship, and I don't really know if that's the case, but I wanted to give listeners a bit of tactical on this, because men who are single will have certainly heard of this concept of abundance mindset, and that you need an abundance mindset to have success with women, to have a successful relationship. This is a pretty common meme in like the relationship personal development space. And your story in the first book would seem to be an illustration of what can happen when someone goes into dating right out of a divorce without enough of an abundance mindset, that they find a beautiful person with that they have amazing chemistry with, and then somewhere in their mind they say it's worth the trouble. But I want to give people a practical, tactical thing for this. the advice that the like the pickup artist crowd is going to give men is that to get an abundance mindset, you just need to sleep with a lot of women. Like you should be sleeping with like a couple a month. Like you should be sleeping with a couple a month, and then you'll have this magical abundance mindset. And then when the woman who's really decent comes along, then you cut loose the other ones and you focus on the one that you have some hope of a future with. And I have a bunch of problems with that approach that I detail in my book, but I've got a really good hack for this because I've been in places where I had scarcity with women. I was not that confident with women. And this is one of these catch-22 kind of things, that if you're not that confident with women, you have a hard time getting women and you have a hard time getting that abundance mindset that you need. But there's a really good hack for this, and I bet it's something you're actually familiar with, Stephen, which is the epigenetic mindset transformation meditation technique that was developed, pioneered by Dr. Joe Dispenza. Are you familiar
with this? I know Joe, yeah.
Aha, okay. And so this is a meditation that it takes 50 minutes. And what you do is go into the meditation with kind of an old limiting belief and then with a new, more empowering belief. And then you go through a ego dissolution step. You go through a step where you're kind of like surfing on the astral planes. And then you swap out old belief for new belief. And then you dwell on gratitude, future casting gratitude for the life that will transpire with this new mindset. And this really is an effective tool for getting the abundance mindset, even if you don't have loads of women throwing themselves at you. You could have maybe benefited from doing that a couple of times in between wife number four and Tomos.
Yeah, no. I had an abundance because I'm on stage. I have women throwing themselves at me all the time. It was never an issue for me to find a woman. And hence, I was married four times, right? So I never had a problem finding women. But I'd never met a woman like Tomos, right? That had all those ingredients. So I didn't suffer from any lack in that regard. Not that I don't experience it in other areas of my life. So not that I couldn't help in other areas of my life, but it wasn't anything to do with not having an abundance of women. If I just wanted to have women, I had a Rolls Royce, a Bentley, a mansion. And I dated a lot of women. Was it before or after? It was after Tomos, right? So, I mean, I could date women very easily. It's easy for me to find women. Maybe not now, I'm a little older, right? But back then, it was definitely easy. And I've never suffered from lack in that area. Now, in terms of money, yeah, I suffered from lack. But I had other processes. There's nothing wrong with the one that you had there. But there are many ways to overcome those limiting beliefs, or call them transparent beliefs. Because very often you're not even aware you have those beliefs that are holding you back in any particular arena. So I have other meditation techniques and also strategies in NLP to help you overcome those things, timeline therapy, but they're all equally as good, which you can benefit too. And it sounds like you've done
that. What's timeline therapy? I haven't heard of that one.
Okay, so let's say you had a traumatic experience when you were a child. And when you had that traumatic experience, you were a child. You didn't possess at that time the skill sets, understanding, and confidence and self-esteem that you do now. So you go back in time to that moment when that person did something, or you believe they did something to you, and you change it because you go into that situation as you are today, where that person does not have power over you. And you take control of the situation. You step into your own power in that moment in time when that happened. And then it changes everything all the way from when you were a child throughout your life.
Okay, switching gears here. During the relationship with Tomos, let me guess, You were in your 40s and she was in like her early to mid 30s?
No, I was 54. Right. So I was 54. She was, we're not sure. She used to lie about her age all the time, like a lot of women do. I caught her lying about her age. And, you know, I said, you lied about your age. And she just turned around and said, Stephen, all women lie about their age. You just completely disarmed you. What are you going to say? Right. So I think she was maybe 40, 41, somewhere around there, but I'm not sure.
Ah, okay. So I promised some tough love, some edifying tough love for the audience. There's right. something I think you're dead wrong about in the book.
Okay. All right. Let's go to it.
You made the point repeatedly that you don't regret the relationship, which seems like the mindset high road. But this was a regrettable relationship. And I've got a little monologue as to why. And this is a really important takeaway, especially for single men, especially for successful single men. So I watched a little while back a 3-hour interview with Tim Ferriss. And
Tim, yeah.
In this interview, he reveals something interesting. This guy, Tim, he screwed up something majorly in the life hacking department. He was talking about how he didn't have a family and how this was like the major thing lacking in his life. And so I wrote about this elsewhere. I wrote, this very economically adroit man failed to sell the top of his sexual market value and settle down with a nice girl. He's still single at 47 years old. There's an instructive lesson in this for avaricious men. In the red pill dissident sphere of the internet, men are quick to point out that women's sexual market value tends to peak in their early to mid-20s. It's the age at which women tend to be most able to snag the highest quality long-term partner to form a family with. Yet, many men fail to realize that their sexual market value will also peak and decline as the decades wear on. Many youngish men, they could be in their 20s, maybe 40s, don't prioritize highly the grand adventure of seducing the enduring affections and commitment of a life partner. They just work hard in their careers while doing personal development stuff, sharpening their social skills, biohacking, looks maxing, etc., and dating recreationally. They imagine that in just a few more years of working hard, they will be ready to settle down with their dream girl and have the means to attract and maintain her. But once you do the years or decades of grueling work that it takes to become a relatively high-value man, you're paralyzed by the seemingly limitless options. You never buy a car and take it home from the dealership because the lot is so full of sexy makes and models to test drive. I'm sure that Tim has dated a lot of beautiful women around the world, but now his driveway is empty. Tim has undeniably been a high-value man for decades. He's good-looking, rich, intelligent, a celebrity, and apparently a pretty good dancer. Yet, at almost...
Me too.
Really? Really? What do you like to
do? I'm a very good dancer. I learned to dance in England. I used to go to all-night nightclubs when I was 14.
Uh-huh. Yes,
they And we used to... Yeah, right. I used to dance to Northern Soul. I don't know if you know what Northern Soul is. It's a particular type of music. It comes from America. But anyway, we get a little off track. That's about my misspent youth, which will be a topic of another book. Anyway, but yeah. But you were just saying he's a good dancer. I'm a very good dancer. I love to dance. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to create a dumb AI song in the genre of Northern Soul and add it to the end of this podcast just for you. Okay. So talking about Tim, at almost a century old, he hasn't started a family. This should be called out for the significant failure that it is. Unless he wants to spend tens of thousands of dollars going through the hellish stress of IVF, Tim is going to be looking at women about two decades younger than him, considering that they'll probably date for a few years before getting married. The problem, gents, with waiting this late in life to find a wife and start a family is that, of course, you're going to want a young, beautiful, fertile woman. But to attract this kind of woman in your late 30s or your 40s, you'll need to be a really fucking cool guy. You'll need to be as fun as guys her age. You'll need to be in amazing shape, and you'll need to be financially well-established while not being a boring workaholic. Even if you do a bunch of biohacking and anti-aging stuff to stay youthful in early middle age, your mindset will change. Every year, you'll lose a bit of that cavalier adolescent charm that you need to connect with women in their 20s. She'll want to go out clubbing with her friends till 3 a.m. when you want to stay home and read a book. Also, if you're smart, you are going to not want just any attractive woman in her 20s, but wife material, a woman with a modicum of good traditional values. And in my book, I named a bunch of objective factors to evaluate women by, yes, to judge them. One of these factors is a woman who loves her father and respects his opinions. And, gents, what is her similarly traditional father going to think of his daughter dating a guy a decade or two older than her? He's going to be very skeptical of you. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yeah, I had that experience with my fourth wife. So she was 32. So I was 18 years. I was 48. So I was 16 years older than her. I was pretty close to her father's age. And he wasn't happy, but he said something to me that no one had ever said before, because I was trying to be traditional. He was a Southern Baptist, right? Very, very religious family. And, you know, I went to him to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. And I'd done this a few times, right? So I was expecting him to say, yeah, it'd be great. And he said, well, my concern is the age difference. And I hadn't even thought of it. But yeah, 16 years is a lot of age difference, right? So there is that part of it. And there's, like I said, because of the changes in our society and the dynamics of sexuality, we're coming up against things that past generations didn't have to deal with. So for example, you know, young women now don't want to get married as early because they want to have a career. Right, they want to go out and beat the world and experience things. They want to have a successful career. But then, you know, when they get into the mid to late 30s, they want to settle down and have kids. Not so easy. Not so easy.
Even and this is why. Biologically, not so easy.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about biologically, actually. But yeah, you're right. Not in any regard, but especially biologically. Because the body isn't designed to have kids when you're in your 40s, right? And so they're having to try all these different, you know them all, right? All these different medicines that women are having to do. And it's devastating to them because they thought, I could just have a kid anytime I want. Not true. So, and then, you know, you talked about men wanting women in their 20s. And there are obviously a lot of men that do like that. But that wouldn't be right for me. I've got enough experience to know that, yes, physically it'd be fantastic in the bedroom, be great. But intellectually, we have nothing in common, right? You know, you said they're going to want to go out, go to nightclubs. Yeah, probably that, maybe other things as well. But their interests in everything are going to be different because they were raised with different ideologies. They were raised with different kinds of music and books and teachings. And so they've got a completely different mindset. It doesn't make it impossible for it to work, but it's definitely, the odds are against it because you're from a different generation. And that does create challenges. So these are all things that I guess we've always faced to some degree, but I think it's more prominent now because, as we've already said, there's a much bigger bowl, a lot more people, a lot more women, a lot more men that people get to choose from than they did, you know, a couple of generations ago. So I think there's a lot of confusion out there. Having said that, if you really are clear on your values and what's important to you, as you obviously are, then it's much easier to identify the right kind of woman for you from all the other hundreds of thousands of women that are not of interest to you. So that's why I think what you're saying, you know, you got a lot of young men listening to this, but really get clear about what's important to you and what is a line in the sand. You know, that if they smoke or if they drink or if they do these things, that's over the line. And you're right. The sooner you recognize those things, the easier it's going to be for you to walk away, right? And so you don't find yourself in a toxic relationship. One of the other things that I would just say to the young men listening is this, look, and this sounds a little childish, but I'll explain why. And I thought maybe it was for a while. But you know, when you first meet someone and you fall in love, and there's what they call the honeymoon period, right? And I would always say to the women that I was with, listen, and they'd say, well, you know, it's the honeymoon period. I said, but look, it doesn't have to die off. The only way that's going to happen is if you and I mess it up. It's up to us. But the moment you start to take each other for granted, it's over. Because then the person you met who loved you, has given you all this attention, is gone. And then it's like you start off in the relationship, both of you embraced in the middle of the room. And little by slow, you find yourselves moving further and further apart until you're not even in the same room anymore. So it's really important to remember when you're in a relationship to do the things that pulled you together and not stop doing them just because you're married and feel like you don't have to anymore. You still got to make effort. And people say, well, you know, a relationship should be effortless. No, it isn't. You know, you do things. I've heard you talking before with other of your clients about things that you do on an ongoing basis to make your relationship work, to make it value, how you value each other, how you talk to each other, do all these things that most people don't, Jonathan. You know that, right? You know that most people don't do those things because nobody, they never had anybody like you to talk to them about it, share those things with you, right? So relationships are not easy, right? And the first person you need to work on, as you also say, is yourself, right? You got to work on yourself before you start going, pulling somebody else into your mess, right? And you going into their mess and finding yourself in a situation where you're not happy and they're not happy. And then in the end, you know, one person sometimes then decides to go look for that happiness somewhere else in another person, right? In Ashley Madison, they go on that website and they find themselves cheating on their spouse. And that is only going to continue to lower your self-esteem because you know that you're cheating, even though the other person may not know, you know. That's in your conscious, right? You're consciously aware of that, which makes you feel bad about yourself. As opposed to, I know it sounds easy when you're in a relationship that isn't working, you got to leave. People say, well, it's for the kids. Well, you're not helping the kids because you're showing them what a relationship is, which is unhappiness. And they're learning that from you. You've got to have the strength to leave and know it's for the best for the kids and it's the best for you and it's the best for your partner if the relationship is over. It takes two to tango, but if you're both prepared to work at it, you can figure a way around these things and get back into the patterns that will support a relationship. But staying in the relationship for the wrong reasons is not going to help you or anybody else. So those, you're talking about biohacking, because I know that's the term you like to use. I love that term. But also sometimes you can just emotionally and mentally hack in to other areas of yourself that maybe you'd forgotten about, that maybe you weren't using anymore because you got complacent. And, you know, I'm at a point in my life where I'm not married. I'm not dating. I'm very happy. That doesn't mean that I won't date. It doesn't mean, I'm pretty sure I won't get married again. I think I've given that enough cracks, right? But I'll be in a relationship, but it would be different for me now. You know, I don't ever want to live with someone again, right? I know that about me. I don't want to live with someone. I'd be happy to date them. Let's live in our own places. We can sleep in the same bed for one night, but we don't have to sleep together every night and be in the same house. Because my experiences, and this might be a limiting belief because you obviously are very happy in your marriage the way it is. But for me, you know, my personality, when you want to call it my astrological sign or what you want to call it, I crave and need freedom. And that's why I've been married so many times, because I didn't own that about myself. And I didn't respect that about myself. And so I'd end up in relationships where I felt confined, right? Where I didn't feel the freedom. And then I would resent that. And that would show up in the relationship. It wasn't my partner's fault. It was my fault for not recognizing that about myself, owning it, and making sure I didn't bring anybody else into my mess. And that caused me a lot of trauma, a lot of stress, and a lot of heartache. And so I learned the hard way. So you, like me, like to help people not necessarily have to learn the hard way, right? But learn in a way that can save them from a lot of that tragedy and turmoil and difficulties.
In the book, you wrote, "I broke the pattern in my own way." And you're describing a rough upbringing. You're describing your father, your grandfather, and breaking that pattern. And Stephen, this is why I see this as a regrettable relationship. And this is a point that's a little bit more for the audience than for you, because I'm not going to convince you to regret something you don't regret. But I see this, I think regret can be a good thing, particularly about toxic relationships, because you're not breaking a pattern unless you have children. And alluding to my point about Tim Ferriss and the question that I asked you before we started recording, this relationship burned up the end of your fertility window. This relationship cost you the most important opportunity in life, that of metaphorically becoming like God by creating new life in your image and casting your essence into eternity via the shape of a woman. And yeah, this is why I think that regret can sometimes be useful, because time is of the essence. We underestimate, particularly youngish men, underestimate the amount of time that they have to start a family, and they underestimate the amount of happiness and meaning that it will infuse into their lives. And then my finding has been that men also, I overestimated how difficult it would be to be a father. It's actually a lot more easier than I expected it to be. And so, yeah, so what are your thoughts on that? Is regret categorically a bad thing, that the personal development person should never regret anything?
Well, to go back to what you said at the beginning there, that it's not breaking the pattern if you don't have any children. I don't agree with that, because I broke the pattern for me, Jonathan. I didn't use fear to control. So that is breaking the pattern. Now, it would have continued had I had children, right? Because I wouldn't have done that to them either, right? So that would have been breaking the pattern of the next generation as well. So, and I understand that, listen, I have family members, I have friends who have children, and they say it's the most valuable thing, that the most amazing experience they've had in their entire life. And they say, "Stephen, you're missing out." And I disagree, right? I don't want, certainly not now anyway, I don't want to have children because, as I said earlier, for me, anything that's going to restrict me to take away my freedom is not something I want to do. Now, that might sound irresponsible or childish. I understand. But I own that about myself, right? I own that. Okay. So can I see that, you know, I love kids, right? Whenever I go to a party and there are kids, I'm the one playing with the kids. I am the guy that all the kids are chasing through the house. I'm the guy that's throwing them on and off the bed, catching them and playing with them, as I was with my nieces. But that's being a good uncle. That's different than being a father, right? And so I never, like I said, had my wives wanted to do that, I think I would have said okay, and don't feel that I would have restricted them from doing that. I wouldn't have taken that away from a woman. But it wasn't like I was pushing for it either, right? Saying we got to have kids or anything like that. So now, do I regret not having children? No. If I had children and I didn't have children, you know, if I was in a marriage where we had kids and they were taken away, of course I would regret that, right? I would never want that to happen. That'd be the worst thing I could imagine. But the fact that I don't have children, to me, based on my current awareness, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. And I think more and more people are becoming that way. Fortunately, we have people like you that are not that way and you want to have kids, because otherwise it would be the end of the human race, right? So, but I think more and more people become reticent about having children or just don't want to have children. Now, what are the consequences of that? Well, if more and more people don't want to have kids, we're all going to die, right? Because we've got to have, and you know, one of the biggest issues right now, you listen to Elon Musk and many others are saying the challenge is that we could become extinct, literally, because the birth rate is going down so much. We're not replacing the number of people that die with young people. So, you know, I don't regret it, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, like Elon Musk says, have as many kids as you can, right? So I feel like, yeah, you know, I'm not having any kids. Hopefully someone will take up the slack for me, right? But so first of all, about the breaking pattern thing, it is a pattern that's broken. I don't live the way my father always has, right? And still does. But I love it. I still love him. I love him, right? And now we have a healthy relationship, which we didn't when I wrote the book. If you read the book, my relationship with him was still broken. Oh yeah, one other thing I want to say, which is important. I didn't write the book to try and tell people how to be in a relationship, how to find the right relationship. The book was really written because I wanted to talk about my experiences and, if anything, be a warning to people, you know, what to look for and to recognize those red flags, as you mentioned, right? So you don't have to go through a toxic relationship. I get that. However, I'm sure you've had experiences in your life that when you had those experiences, you might have said something like, this is the worst day of my life, right? Or maybe more than one, right? But as you look back now, you look at that experience and you go, you know what? I wouldn't want to have that again, but I'm glad I had it because I am the person I am today because that happened in my life. So I would say the same thing about this. I'm not trying to be resistant to saying you can't have regrets, but I honestly and truly don't regret having this experience. You know, one of the things that I write in the book a few times is the quote from Charles Dickens. They were the worst of times and they were the best of times. And I say we had the time of our lives. We really did, right? And I got a tremendous amount of learning and growth. I didn't get it all of the time, Jonathan, you know, but later on, when I finally sat down and took time to reflect on my life and that experience, there were so many valuable experiences there. And when I was writing, I'd be laughing and crying and having all these, and I, obviously, you know, I fell in love with her again, right, for everything that happened. But I don't want to go through that again. I had that time. It was an amazing time. And I'm not that person anymore. And I don't crave that experience anymore.
So the book, yeah, it's not really an advice book. I mean, it's great storytelling. Is what, if people want advice, they can get it from my books. Yeah, the storytelling, I really enjoyed the airplane and the cruise ship stories were really wild. I shared those with my wife. So yeah, people will have to read the book for that. The storytelling will grab you by the balls or the pussy. And in my review, I wrote, "The author's very dry sense of humor adds levity to what otherwise might feel like an extended cautionary tale. If my book is about how to build a cathedral, Venus Flytrap is about what happens when you invite a demon into it."
This is my book, by the way. This is my book.
Oh, okay. You did. You got it in print. Okay. Good.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been up a while. I've got actually book two just came out, Jonathan.
Haha.
It's a three. There's three books in the series. This is the so this one is the first book, right? Sex, Lies, and Repercussions. The second one, which is out now, is called The Venus Flytrap. Enough is Never Enough.
James Bond movie title, but it fits. It fits the epic of Stephen and Tomos, or whatever her name is. So those.
Hey, you know, I just thought real quick, you're funny this because you talk about James Bond titles. The third book is called The Venus Flytrap, The Day After Tomorrow.
Okay, yeah. I see what you did there. Okay, so people can find those linked below wherever they are watching or listening to us.
You could just let people know that those links that I sent you are, one is to the copy of the first three chapters of the book for free. And then the other link is, as I do relationship coaching, right, is to get a special deal on coaching. And also to get a free complimentary session if people are interested.
Ah, okay. How long is the free complimentary session?
30 minutes.
Okay. If people want to chat with a charming British guy for 30 minutes, this is their chance.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it has more meaning than just having a chat. But yeah. So I'm a wealth coach. I'm a health coach. I'm a relationship coach. Yeah, so I do a lot of different. I've been a coach for 20 years.
Okay, right on. We'll make sure to have all that stuff linked up. Two closing thoughts on this one. I think my disagreements with Stephen are due to differences in worldview. He has a PhD in spiritual counseling, and he sees Tomos as a master teacher who galvanized his spiritual growth. That's why he doesn't regret the relationship. And that's probably helpful framing with this relationship in the rear view. I am also a bit woo-woo and consider myself a spiritual person, but I take a more pragmatic view. Toxic relationships, like the cinematically toxic one described in his book, come at the opportunity cost of beautiful, uplifting, edifying relationships. Relationships that can bear the ultimate fruit. So please, please, please don't use the idea of a master-teacher dynamic, and I'm sure this is a dynamic that goes by a lot of different names. Don't use that as an excuse to stay in toxic relationships. When relationships start to turn toxic, and especially if you have those inklings, those red flags in the beginning, just start moving your feet, metaphorically or literally, toward the door. Second thought, pain can be a teacher, as it sounds like it was for Stephen. But pain is not the only teacher in life. You can learn life lessons by metabolizing information into wisdom. That's what we're trying to impart here. You can learn life lessons by conversations with friends and mentors, and via good storytelling, the kind that you can find in Venus Flytrap. So add it to your reading list. For a final laugh, I wrote a song about Stephen and Thomas's relationship. From the perspective of Thomas's little dog named Disco, which I'll add to the end of this podcast. I'm Jonathan Roseland with Limitless, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.
Tuxedo, a party poodle with pedigree and style. I was the British white knight for two moles and a smile. He was fresh off divorce number four when he typed in a search looking for a miracle, but he ended up left in the lurch. She sent him short haikus while he wrote her a novel or two. I'm Disco the poodle and I knew exactly what she'd do to you. I'll be your dream, I'll be your wish, I'll be your fantasy. Till I'm finally through, I'm a miniature tuxedo party, the third one she's kept in her care, with demands as large as a mansion and a pension for expensive flair. Stephen better bring home human dinners from the finest restaurant seats. Filet mignon and fancy treats are the only things this poodle eats. He thinks he's the master of manifesting magic and power, but I'm the one who really runs the house hour after hour. Ships are part of my scene. Watching Stephen play detective while she acts like a gone girl queen. She vanished from the suite, leaving him to check the TV screen in fear. Watching $5,000 in casino charges suddenly appear. He's chasing a ghost while she's chasing the high of the bet. I'm the only one on the ship he hasn't disappointed yet. Through the lies and the role playing, the miracles and the dead. He's the fly in the trap, the most desperate speaker she's met yet. He thinks he's her escape from Gianni and the life she had before, but she's the predator who always leaves the white knight on the floor. When the Rolls Royce is gone and the paddock has lost its shine, Tomas and Disco will still be doing just fine. Limitless mindset.